So my guess is that, I mean, the only people who I think would talk and think about using nuclear bunker busters against now are Iran or North Korea in a variety of circumstances. My thing, my question, if I had to make a list of the things that I think would inhibit that from happening, number one, the expectation that the fallout would kill a lot of people, non-combatants in the enemy country and also non-combatants in our allied countries. We don't like to kill non-combatants. Number two would be breaking the nuclear taboo, and it would be deeply embarrassing to the United States and discredit the leader who did that. Number three, we're trying to marginalize nuclear weapons, and it would be seen to be counter to that. So I think there's, and number four, we expect to be able to win our conventional wars without going nuclear. So I think there are 50 things that would make a president, you know, not want to go nuclear now and into the future that have nothing to do with these things. And that's really kind of about the second part of this. Yes, sir.
All right. We know he's will.
Will.
But for the first one and two, views one and two,
existential and minimal.
Right. Could those be better considered for if you have a country where one country has nuclear weapons and the other one has more of a conventional force and would be a turn for conventional force, but three and four are assured destruction and assured retaliation?
Yep.
Are better understanding of deterrence for countries that both have nuclear weapons, especially of a substantial size?
It could be, but I'll tell you, the people who believe in existential and minimal deterrence think that they're just perfectly fine and sufficient for deterring nuclear armed states. And it's not a crazy thought. They say, look, expected outcomes are a function of two things, the probability of the outcome and the consequences of it, right? And so they say, even if the probability of retaliation, because my arsenal is so small, you'll probably destroy it all. Yeah, but there's some chance you won't. And think about what's going to happen to you if you don't. And so they'd say is that, with people who believe in existential minimal deterrence would say is, even small, vulnerable arsenals will have a heavy deterring effect against a nuclear armed state.
Would you say it would have a heavier effect against the conventionally armed state?
I don't know the answer. I don't know.
Okay.
But they would say that it's a sufficient deterrent force. If you believe in existential minimal deterrence, it's sufficient deterrent force for deterring a nuclear armed state. All right, so what we've done now is laid out these four theories. Here's like an ugly, ridiculous slide. I once thought this was a big slide. My co-author, this is all co-authored work. I'm with Kier Lieber at Georgetown, really smart, nice guy. So he, right here, stands in and makes some joke about the Rasta colors and the horror of using Rasta colors to describe kind of a spectrum of violence and mass murder. But I was talking to him a stupid joke, and we shouldn't make this. And then, of course, here I am for myself making a stupid joke. But basically, existential deterrence says that, you know, look, it really doesn't matter where you are on the probability. Any probability here, low probability, is sufficient to deter. And it doesn't matter if the attacking power is going to receive a few warheads or lots of warheads in response. The whole space, really scary, really deterring. Okay, that's existential deterrence. Minimal deterrence says you have to make it more likely than that in order to deter, but that should be enough. Assured retaliation says, no, you have to make it very likely, in fact, close to certain. And assured destruction says, yeah, and it also better be, like, biblical, right? You know, in terms of the retaliatory effect. And that's kind of the argument as we've laid it out. Yes, sir?
My name is Logan.
Hey, Logan.
I think that you and Kier Lieber wrote this essay about, like, U.S. nuclear privacy and foreign affairs.
Yeah, a couple years ago.
And you're saying, like, how the United States right now is, like, reaching this level where it's going to be, like, the sole nuclear power in the world. Does like the United States being aware of nuclear privacy kind of accommodate having the opportunity to use disproportionate force to retaliate against even outside actors who are being housed in government states that have government that aren't being cooperative? Kind of like, I think it's like the movie Swordfish.
Okay, two people right now, no John Travolta movies, unless it's John Travolta. Okay, go ahead.
What does Marcellus Wallace look like?
Ha, touche. Nice.
But anyways, so does that, like, does the idea of nuclear primacy, does that kind of accommodate the United States responding with disproportionate force against a non-state actor?
I know a little bit about this. I think the United States government, the previous, the George W. Bush administration, the current administration, the Carter administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, would want to avoid the U.S. use of nuclear weapons under virtually any circumstances. I think you could construct some circumstances where we'd be willing to use them first. I mean, that's really what you're talking about. I think we desperately would like to avoid that. And so I don't think that the capabilities U.S. developed, and we're going to present some of that in the second half. I keep saying the second half, and the second half better be good now, because the capabilities that we've developed that give us some really new capabilities in this line, I think the circumstances under which we'd use them are very narrow. So, yeah, it could give us some capabilities against Al-Qaeda leaders, but I don't think that's where we're going. All right. So there are the four. There's the little roster slide. Where do we stand? So now what we're going to do, if anybody still remembers where we are, we're now going to walk through. I'm going to say, okay, so those are four theories that each claim to explain how deterrence works. Now I'm going to walk through the changes in the Soviet nuclear arsenal over time. And then we're going to say, all right, well, which one of them, where did they how high up the ladder of capability did they have to go until we changed our way of thinking about nuclear weapons using those criteria we described before? Overall defense concepts for NATO, escalatory triggers and targets, okay? So that's what we're going to do. So track the growth of Soviet nuclear capabilities through their phase of having an existential deterrent, into their phase of having a minimal deterrent, into that, and then track the U.S. strategic doctrine and see when this changed, and then ask, did the growth in Soviet nuclear capabilities affect U.S. strategic doctrine? Maybe it didn't.
But the critical thing here is for the defense of Europe, is your parameter here, not for the defense of the United States.
Yes, defense of Europe, right. The overall defense concept for Europe. All right, so that's what we've done. Don't worry, they're not all equally long. We're not going to be here all afternoon. Well, actually, we are going to be here all afternoon, but not doing this presentation. All right. So let's start now. Now we're getting some history.
And can I just interrupt?
Yes, please.
Somebody's going to be introducing this concept of extended deterrence.
Yeah. So extended deterrence is trying to deter attacks of some nature, attacks on others. So during the Cold War, the United States was interested in deterring attacks on the United States, but it was also focused on deterring attacks on West Europe. In fact, in some ways, I think what the Cold War was really all about, the core issue was the defense of Western Europe from NATO's standpoint. It ended up getting fought in East Asia for other reasons, but the core issue was this. So anyway, so World War II ends, and I'd say a lot of colleagues, including my very good friend and colleague and a smart guy, Bill Wolford, has done some terrific work characterizing the balance of power over time. And he characterizes the era right after World War II as this period of U.S. global dominance. You know, the United States is part of this giant coalition that slays the bad guys, the Nazis, the Japanese, imperialists, and sits atop the world where basically all the other powers in the world are basically defeated and destroyed. Even the winners, like Britain, is one, but they're just a rubble, right? And the United States is super powerful and has like 52% of global world output in terms of the economy. And this is just the peak of U.S. hegemony. And I think he's so far wrong. The evidence about kind of the most important issue from U.S. strategic planners' viewpoint, their viewpoints in the late 1940s was, how do we defend Europe in case Joe Stalin decides, well, I can now pick up the prize that European countries have been fighting over since Napoleon, if not earlier, which is for years and years, nobody was able to conquer and consolidate all of Europe. And then the Nazis were the last ones to try it as of then. But now Europe is just a wasteland. The people are on the verge of starvation. The Continental armies are a wreck. And the Russians, their country is really messed up by World War II, but they have the huge Red Army sitting there in Eastern Europe, you know, busy terrorizing and pillaging in Eastern Europe. But the U.S. defense planners looked at this and said, we have a big problem, which is as soon as the war ended, the United States demobilized its army and went back home, and the military balance in Europe, now, these are not exactly right, but these are the JCS estimates of what the military balance in Europe was. It was Joint Chiefs of Staff. The United States had two army divisions in Europe, actually in garrison duty. They were garrisoning Western Europe, Western Germany. I think the Brits had one, or maybe two. And the Soviets were estimated as having 135. Now, you don't have to be an expert in military analysis. You don't even have to know how many guys are in a division to know that that's an unfavorable balance. You know, 135-2, 62.5-1. You might be off. It might be that a bunch of those Soviet divisions were in no shape for offensive operations. They weren't. It might have only been 100-2. The bottom line with the JCS's assessment, if I can paraphrase it, was, we're screwed. Am I allowed to say that?
You are.
That was their assessment of the military balance in Europe. And so they were tasked. They were like, okay, put together a war plan by the Truman administration. Suppose the Russians invade Western Europe. And again, there before them was the prize that countries in Europe had fought over for hundreds of years, and there was basically nothing between them and the English Channel. Like, well, suppose Joseph Stalin turns out to be a nasty guy, he kind of was, and decides to pick that up. How would we defend Europe? And they're like, well, this was our war plan. Our war plan, which doesn't always go quite as well as we hope, estimated levels of Soviet advance as a, by date. They said, well, they'll be at the Pyrenees by 6 day plus 60, and we're in the Pyrenees, not on the inter-German border, on the Franco-Spanish border, meaning with our plan, if things went as well as we hoped, they wouldn't get all the way through France until 2 months in. That's bad, right? That's losing. We thought that they wouldn't get to Iran, seize Iran, Iraq. Why are they going to go to Iran and Iraq? Oil for the military operation. They probably wouldn't get to there for 2 months. They probably wouldn't get to the Yellow River in China and get all of South Korea just to push us off the entire land until 150 days. And so our plan basically was we were going to lose the English Channel to basically the Yellow Sea within the first 5 months. Now, again, plans don't always go quite as well as you hope, but that was the plan. Now, we had lots of genius kind of innovations in this plan. Like, where were we going to try to, you know, get the U.S. forces that survived this onslaught? I don't think anyone would. But where were we going to try to evacuate them from the continent? We racked our brains. We did a bunch of careful planning. We came up with an idea. Dunkirk. That was brilliant. That's where the Brits pulled off their force, you know, World War II, when the Germans were sweeping through. And then our plan was, okay, they've kicked us off the continent, but what we will do is try to hold the English Channel, try to hold the Mediterranean, and kind of launch, as I'll describe it in a minute, a slow-motion nuclear atomic offensive of the Russians. Remember, we have atomic bombs at this point. And our plan was, in about two and a half years, we'll get ourselves back on the continent. Anyone want to guess? So the brilliant planners try to figure out where might be some good points to get back on the continent. And you're on guess with two. We identified two good ones. What? Normandy. Don't tell anyone. This is a secret. Normandy was one we thought about coming back on. And the other one being somewhere in southern Italy we planned on. So anyway, it wasn't the most creative military planning in the history of U.S. military operations. So the real point was our plan was then we're going to do a do-over on World War II. But this time we're just going to be lobbing an atomic offensive at them, et cetera. Our plan was to lose Europe from the English Channel to the Sea of Japan. This was not a period where we thought we had the world wrapped up. We thought we were opposed. Well, what about the nuclear arsenal? Clearly, we're going to win this war because we had atomic bombs and they didn't. Game over, right? Well, actually, not so much. So we had a few dozen atomic bombs, depending on the year, 47, 49, we had a couple. But the arsenal was a nightmare. First of all, our bombers couldn't reach Russia from the United States. They had to stage out of our allies around Russia, which made sense, out of Britain. We planned to conduct operations from Alexandria. There was a nice long airfield in Alexandria, Egypt, Karachi, Pakistan, and Okinawa, and other places on the Japanese island. We're going to launch bombers. So great. So we have allies nearby. The bombers can reach their targets in Russia. Great. Problem? The fighter planes couldn't reach Russia. And so what that meant is the bombers are going to have to fly over Russia unescorted. And we don't have 10,000 of these. We had about 121 at that point. Now, your mental image might be like the bombing of Japan, a bombing of Germany. That was after the United States had swept all the air defense fighters out of Japan, basically. This was, while the Soviets controlled the airspace over all of Eurasia, we're going to fly like groups, they were supposed to be little groups of three B-29 bombers, alone in a maze of fighter planes, trying to drop bombs. Nightmare. Nightmare number one. Nightmare number two is, in this age of Google Earth, we assume everybody knows where everything is, right? Our targets in this were Russian cities. We had no idea where Russian cities were. So the SAT maps, the maps of the Strategic Air Command, they were Tsarist-era maps, hand-drawn Tsarist-era maps. They didn't know where these cities were. They knew roughly. It was like, yeah, I think it's like up that road a couple hundred miles. And they were going to have to bomb these targets at night because daytime bombing was going to be impossible without suppressing the air defenses. So groups of three bombers over hostile territory against cities whose location they didn't know at night. Russian cities in 1947 were not a blaze of electric lights. And furthermore, the lights would be out. There was just no chance this was going to work, and we knew it. The bombers were going to get lost. They were going to fail to find their targets. They were going to get shot down because they didn't have air cover. We only had, again, the number went up to 200. And lastly, and this is just kind of unnecessary, but the lethal radius of a 20 kiloton bomb is about a mile. It'll destroy buildings out to about a mile from the detonation. The average miss distance in training in the daylight over Nevada was a mile, which means that they were not getting many bombs in the dark within a mile of where they were aiming for, in the dark and getting shot down.
Introduced to the concept of CEP.
Yeah, circular error problem, the average miss distance.
It's critical when you start to think about the evolution of these weapons.
And I have to say, it'll be important for the second talk in 2 hours, an hour and a half. I don't know who's first. Who wants to go? Yes, sir. Guy with the crazy skull.
Would you consider this
on a shirt.
Point
yeah.
Minimal deterrence on the side of the United States?
Because they don't have the effective... I never thought about it. From the standpoint, the way I'm looking at it, this is a period of nuclear monopoly. Here the Russians have zero nuclear power. And so let's just kind of keep that as the frame. We're going to walk through different levels of Russian deterrent capability. Here they got nothing. It's 47 to 49.
But with what we said, with what you just said, we really don't have anything either. We have a bomb, but...
I'd say this is somewhere between assured retaliation, I guess. Is that probably, are atomic bombs going to fall somewhere on Russia? Yes. Are they going to hit the right places in Russia? No. Would I want to live in Moscow while this was going on? No. Although you might be perfectly fine. I'm guessing they could defend Moscow in this era. So,
And it also presumes, looking at Chernobyl, that they'll tell somebody about what's going on inside their country, which is absolutely critical when it comes to the whole question of decision-making when you think about what happened with the Japanese between Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm. So there are layers that we'll try to get to when we try to think about this. This is may sound like historical framework, but we're dealing with large, long-term current implications.
Yes, sir, Joel?
Did Truman and Churchill realize this at Potsdam, and did that possibly... force their positions to a certain extent?
I have no idea. I don't know when they knew this. It's a good question. That's right. People often ask, but you know, that's an important point. People often frame the Churchill and Truman decisions in this frame of Allied supremacy. You know, here was the chance, because Russia was just savaged by the Germans in World War II, and the United States was left, you know, unscathed. And in kind of economic terms, we were this giant. And people cast the Churchill and the Truman decisions as, why did they make the decisions they were? Maybe they did have some inkling of this. I don't know.
All right. So anyway, so that was the situation.
Until 1949. 1949, we get into the era of Soviet nuclear deterrence, Soviet nuclear test. This, by our framework, is the period of existential deterrence. So the Soviets have no long-range bombers. Their bombers, remember I said our bombers, B-29s, had to operate from places near theirs. You know what kind of bomber they were flying? A B-29. They called it something else, a TU-4, but they stole one of our B-29s in the war and they copied it. So they had the same bomber as us. What was this?
Didn't they have the same bomb as us, too, in 1949?
I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. There was a lot of nuclear cooperation going on there. That's what we call it, cooperation. So they had no forward bases, so they couldn't reach us. Their medium-range planes could do one-way missions, but they didn't even train for this. They weren't planning over the pole. They weren't training over the pole. Their bombers didn't fly training routes toward us. They didn't fly reconnaissance planes over the pole to look for routes. They just weren't even, you know, threatening us or suggesting they were going to do anything in terms of retaliating against the United States. Their deterrent, such as it was about retaliation against Europe. But from our standpoint, this was the period of existential deterrence, which is they had a bomb, but they had no way plausibly of delivering it against the United States, and we knew it. Yes, sir.
Sorry, just to clarify, the reason Russia didn't take over all of Europe and Asia was, they had economic problems, people were fighting. You presented it in the last slide as like this inevitable doomsday situation.
Well, just this opportunity, which they didn't take.
But it never happened.
Yeah.
So why?
Great question. There's an awesome historical question. Maybe it's been answered, though I don't know, which is for that, what you'd want to do is you'd want to have people who really studied Stalin's military and political decision-making in the late 40s. And one possibility is they might have thought we had hundreds and hundreds of atomic bombs and would annihilate them. So it might have been enough to deter them. Another possibility, we don't know kind of what battles Stalin, most of Stalin's battles were in his head and against the Soviet communists. He might have thought his big threat was people trying to purge him. But it's great, it's an empirical question, which is people who really, really have been into the Stalin archives, if they're open, should answer those things. I don't know.
They are open, a good portion of them is sister group to the National Security Archive, and it's the Cold War archive that Jim Hirschberg, who's a former Tufts student.
Cold War International History Project.
Exactly.
They're terrific, too. Now, I think that stuff has really dried up in the past. Their work hasn't dried up, but the Soviets, the Russians, became very open right after the end of the Cold War, and then drew in closed.
But Jim Hirschberg is a former student here, our corporate action here, and we do have access to a lot of this period. Timothy Colton stuff might help. It's a question when people are looking for research questions, it's, you know, you should be thinking about this continually as you listen to things.
That's a great research question, Ian. Why didn't Solon go for it? Maybe he didn't want him. Maybe he was a nice guy. I mean, we know he wasn't.
Oh, I'm joking. I'm joking. All right. So that was there's the period of existential deterrence. They have bombs, but they don't have delivery systems against the U.S. Now here's the period of minimal deterrence. 1956, they developed their first long-range bomber that can reach the United States. So now they have nuclear weapons and long-range bombers that can get to the United States. Now, just because they can get to the United States doesn't mean the bombers are survivable. I mean, quite to the contrary, their bombers barely could reach the U.S., and it meant they had to refuel this handful of Arctic air bases. Arctic air bases for a good portion of the year in Russia, not a good place to operate from. Also, understand that the shortest flight routes between Russia and the United States were over the North Pole, and what this meant was that our bombers, if this thing happened, would be going over the pole on their way to the Russian targets, and the very first thing we would hit would be the Arctic air bases, their critical refueling bases on the way. Toward the end of this period, so 56 through 61, so these are the number of bombers they have. Those are the weapons assigned to them. They start in 58, they get their first submarines that had a nuclear mission. But those submarines are not like modern submarines. They were loud. They had to surface to get more air all the time. And they operated solely off of Europe. They had big operational limitations.
What you mean by loud is?
They made all kinds of, the way you find submarines underwater is principally through sonar, through the sound they emit. And so the big difference in submarines are they loud or are they quiet? Quiet subs are invisible, more or less. Loud submarines are very easy to find and detect. So these were not only loud submarines that were relatively easy to find and detect, but they weren't for this mission. They were for operating around Europe and threatening European cities. They never came across the Atlantic. They started to do their first patrols across the Atlantic toward 1961. The Russians also remember how, you know, Sputnik happened, what, in 57? They got their first operational ICBMs in 1960, a couple of them. ICBMs being long-range missiles, nuclear missiles. Got about 12. The point being is you start off here, 55. They don't have any way of retaliating against the United States. This is the period where they do have a means of retaliation, but it's vulnerable. Why is it vulnerable? Well, here, let me ask you, see if you think like a SAC planner yet. So we're in this era. There you go. See if you can think. Now everybody, kind of channel Curtis LeMay. You know who Curtis LeMay is? Okay, channel Curtis LeMay here. You know the Russians have long-range bombers that could reach the United States. It's your task to be able to destroy them in case the president orders you to do so. You don't have the kind of intelligence we have today. You don't know where those bombers are located. Luckily, you know where You know where some Russian airfields are. What's your strategy for destroying those bombers? You have no idea where they're located. You also don't know in a crisis where they'll displace to, because they won't be in the bases in a crisis. They'll go to different places. So what's your targeting strategy?
Everything,
yes. And what is the definition of everything? Every military airfield, check. Every civilian airfield, check. Every airport, check. Every long concrete straight strip that you can identify in Russia. I'm not joking. Yeah, two thermonuclear weapons, right? It's the equivalent of Tarantino double tap, basically. That's what you do. That's your targeting strategy. So, and the point was because these bombers, they existed, they could have reached the United States, but if you hit the Arctic air bases on the way in, and then you smash every airfield in the Soviet Union to get all their bombers. These ICBMs, they started getting them, though their numbers are few here, they took between 12 and 24 hours to fuel. So they're vulnerable, too. They probably have about 3 hours' notice from when the bombers came over the pole when they first saw them, unless we had managed to find holes in their radar, which there's lots of evidence we did, in which case they'd have much less time. But so anyway, the point being is this is the period of minimal deterrence. Do they have a nuclear arsenal? Yes. Do they have delivery systems that could reach the United States? Yes. Is it invulnerable to attack? No. You know, and our view is it kind of the vulnerability is declining over time. And it's not like 61 there's a hard line. It's starting to get hard to destroy it all. And it gets harder yet as you go on. Yes, sir, in the back.
Patrick. So before solid fuel ICBMs, you couldn't just leave an ICBM
There are different kinds of liquid fuel ICBMs, different kinds of liquid. There's storable liquid and unstorable liquid. And I think it has to do with the corrosiveness of the fuel. But these were non-storable, where you had to prepare the fuel and then load it up. And a lot of these things blew up in terms of the loading the fuel. In fact, the Russians' very first, I think it was their first ICBM test. Yeah, I can't remember if it was the first, so it was clearly post-Sputnik, but it was their first ICBM test. They brought, and they're, I mean, I shouldn't be laughing. They brought all these engineers, all the senior people in their Russian strategic forces to watch the glorious first loss, and not only did it blow up and kill all these people, and it set back their ICBM, you know, program for a year, because they all got blown up and killed. So they decapitated their own capability, which, again, I don't know why we're laughing. It's terrible. Yes, sir?
Dan again.
Dan.
So does the fact that they had developed their nuclear weapons by this point contribute to the fact that they have been elevated to minimum deterrent status?
In some world, it should have. You know, we're trying to simplify, but we're doing this just by delivery systems. Can they deliver them? Yes. Is it an invulnerable delivery system? No. Yes. Yeah, so another big change happened was their development of thermonuclear weapons, which made each bomb much more capable.
Yeah.
This is what we describe as a period of assured destruction. And this is kind of a period of assured retaliation. It's not that 61 and 62 are totally different worlds. It's that as you're getting into 61, it's like you look at that force structure, 150 bombers, well, it's still the same number of airfields. You know, 40 subs, you know, nine sub-10s, they're pretty loud. Some of them are patrolling off our coast now, we're trailing them. You could probably get them all, but probably, you know, 12 ICBMs, you should be able to get those. That's like you probably can get them all. This is, it's going to be really hard. You know, the bomber number is still high, their submarines 48, now they've got 38 ICBMs. It's not, I mean, again, it's not a firm line. It's that now you're getting to the world where the odds of something not working, something getting through, is getting pretty high. But this is actually what we end up relying upon. So the Joint Chiefs of Staff reported to the President in 1961, when he got the update on what happens in World War III, are we going to win or lose? They said, we're going to win. Still in 61. Maybe they're wrong, but they were telling the President, we're going to win, but we might get hit with a few. That was their assessment. 63, they tell the President, we can't win in any meaningful way. So somewhere in that, I don't know, 61, 62, 63, you get from the world of, you know, of we can win and we get them all, which is beforehand, to we can win, we're going to get hit by a few, to we're all going to lose this thing.
Okay, so it's not the Soviets will win, it's everybody die.
Oh yeah, we're going to be so much worse off. American society is going to be destroyed, or just set back. It's not that they win, right? Yes, Ian, and then, okay.
The 63 assessment has nothing to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis, because those missiles have been removed by then.
I don't know if they've actually been removed, but right, it's after the crisis. The crisis is, what, October 62, I'm trying to remember? November, October 62. So this is after. I mean, the president just got, sometimes he got briefings in the middle of the crisis. Yeah, I mean, there's tons of interesting stuff here. In the middle of the Berlin crisis, the president asked for one of these briefings where, again, it shows that actually this isn't just academic construct. This is how the leaders were thinking. The president sends this memo, which is a fascinating memo, that says, he sends it through his military advisor, whose name I can't remember, but it says, the president would like a briefing tomorrow. So right then, your ears should perk up. And I think, close to a direct quote, the quote was, because circumstances in Berlin might require us to go to general nuclear war imminently, the president requires the following information tomorrow. And he has like 14 questions which the president wanted answered. And the questions were of the nature of, if we launch a nuclear force strike first, what are the odds that we'll be able to surprise the Russians significantly? Number two, if we attack solely their long-range strategic nuclear weapons, what are the odds we'll destroy them all? Number three, and he had different arguments, if I launch this attack, how long will I have to call it back before it's too late? Number five, so again, this is how the president and his most senior advisors were thinking about the military balance, about the vulnerability of Russian retaliatory forces and whether we could get them all.
This could be Maxwell Taylor.
Yeah, it might have been Taylor. Why is Goodpaster also?
Was Goodpaster was there. Yeah.
It was either Taylor or Goodpaster. I think it might have been Taylor. You might be right. Yes, sir.
It looks like bombers and submarines don't really increase. They stay pretty stagnant. I mean, bombers go up a little bit. Submarines don't move at all. ICBMs, of course, go up not exponentially, but substantially. How many submarines and bombers did the U.S. have, not in the bomber, in submarines? Because our number of bombers continued to go up. Actually went down.
Yeah, I don't have the U.S.
bombs went up on the bombers.
I can't remember. Do you remember when the first U.S. Oh, was that right around 60, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The first,
because I was a Rickover fellow at the Naval Academy.
Oh, you were. So Rickover was the guy who ran the nuclear navy. So you know, so when was our first?
1960 is when this threshold was hit.
Yeah, for whatever reason, I don't know why. I don't have the U.S. partly, I think, you know what, because what we're talking about here is, again, the vulnerability of Russian forces. The United States had its first nuclear-powered ballistic missile-launching submarine, but it wasn't...
The capability, you know, we're talking about capabilities, as I said, it was on the threshold of really being assertive.
Yes, and the missiles were probably not very accurate, certainly not accurate enough to attack many of these targets. I don't know exactly why we
don't
have that
problem. They had trouble with the silos, I mean, with the equivalent of the silos.
Yeah, the launch tubes.
So Russia had launch tubes, but we didn't?
No. Yeah, the Russian submarines are diesel-electric submarines, which surfaced and launched cruise missiles, which is totally different. A cruise missile is an unmanned airplane, which is totally different than the kind of weapons we were talking about.
How many of those do the U.S. have?
I don't know the answer to that.
Very small.
Very small.
Initially, this kind of capability, very small.
But the key thing is this, is that wasn't the U.S. offensive nuclear striking force.
The submarine, part of this deterrence was considered to be the last case of resort.
And it might have been used against Soviet surface ships or ports.
Ports, the first conception, because of the capable error probable is difficult in terms of the launching.
That's my guess. I don't have a crystal clear answer, but that sounds right. They're probably used against ports. When you talked about the U.S. launching a first strike on the Russians at this time, this was the main force, the bomber force. And these play an increasing role as time goes on. But yes, ma'am?
I was thinking about what you were saying. And wouldn't also submarines have a larger effect on attacking the U.S. than our submarines are attacking Russia just because of the geography? I mean, a submarine can get much closer to U.S. cities than we can with Russia. Because of ice, they don't even really have viable ports in the more populated areas of the country.
Yeah,
so wouldn't submarines just have been...
In the era in which submarines were launching these kind of slow cruise missiles, my guess is the principal use was against port cities and post-to-port naval targets.
So St. Petersburg and
Normandy? Perhaps, but I don't know where the U.S. was operating. Again, this is the era of diesel-electric submarines where your fuel limit, you have big fuel limits. Diesel-electric submarines, diesel-electric submarine, it's a Prius. It's the very first Prius, which is what it does is it has a battery, and then it charges the battery by running an internal combustion engine, just like the Prius. That's but a little less green, I would have to admit. But the trick on the diesel electric submarine is what do you need in order to run an internal combustion engine? Air. And so that's the trick, is the submarine can go really quietly under the water on battery power and not emit carbon, and then every once in a while it has to stick its snorkel up near the surface, draw in a bunch of air, run the loud diesel engine, charge up the battery, and then it can go back. But doing that all the way across to Murmansk and across the Atlantic, I don't need to know if that's how we intend to operate them. But anyway, we're in the weeds now. Deterrence. Here, let me summarize all of that. Back to the Rasta colors. So, three different theories of deterrence. Our point is, now we're trying to lay those theories against the timeline. This is the period of U.S. monopoly. This is the period in which the Soviets had nuclear weapons, but they didn't have long-range bombers. This is the period of minimal deterrence. They now can reach us, but it's vulnerable. And then this is where it just starts getting essentially invulnerable. It's not that individual legs were invulnerable. It's that the whole system itself was sufficiently big, sufficiently diversified, sufficiently balanced, that it was unlikely we were going to get them all. And that was at least the assessment of Joint Chiefs of Staff, like, we can't get them all. All right? All right, so what does this tell us? This one's quick. I have one slide for the whole darn thing. It's ugly. But basically, what was the U.S. war plan, NATO's war plan? I told you a little bit about this in the early period. So 47 to 49, what was our concept of operations? It was phase number one, the first priority, conventional retreat. You know, trying to get whatever forces you can off the continent before they all get overrun. And then number two is you launch an atomic offensive against Russian cities. So there wasn't even a defense of Europe plan. There was a loss of Europe plan. But it was conventional retreat, atomic offensive, escalatory triggers. Well, as soon as they invade Western Europe, we're not waiting for anything. We're going to start launching nuclear weapons, but in a slow, deliberate way. 30 days to complete the atomic attacks. Those are the targets were all city targets. 20 cities in 1948, 70 cities in 1949 when we got more bombs. That was the war plan. All right? The Soviets detonate a nuclear weapon. The period of existential deterrence is on us. What did it do? Did it change the way we thought about nuclear weapons? Did it make us say, well, that's a little too dangerous, let's go a different route? Well, it did change the way we planned to defend Europe, but in the exact opposite way that the existential deterrence theory would predict. It didn't make us say, okay, well, look, nuclear weapons are off the table. We've got to find a new way of defending Europe. It said, a
atomic attacks have to happen rapidly and at the outset of the war. It can no longer be deliberate, it can no longer be slow. The attacks have to be rapid, and now the targets got flipped over. And instead of cities being the primary target, cities were the secondary target. And the primary target for U.S. nuclear forces were what?
Airfield weapons and Russian nuclear weapons.
Yeah, Russian nuclear weapons and airfields as a way of blunting their nuclear forces. So that's what the conventional... The Russians spent a lot of Russian money, killed a lot of Russian guys in the mining of uranium, and their kind of payoff from this was now the atomic operations have to commence much more quickly and with no delay. Hold on one second. Then the Russians develop, go up the next step on kind of this ladder. They're now in the age of minimal deterrence. Congratulations, you now have bombers that can reach the United States. Did that make us change the war plan? Well, yes, it did, just kind of faster and more targets. And so this was this era where, by nuclear targets, I should say, those were targets associated with the Russian nuclear force. So this is the era. Remember that, from 1956, they had, a couple hundred nuclear weapons. Why were we hitting 670 targets associated with that? It's because, again, it was every long strip of pavement in Russia was receiving a couple. And so that was the way. So again, they get a minimal deterrent force. It just means that we're escalating the nuclear offensive and we're hitting more and more targets. What's really interesting is this period. From about 57 to 59, there are repeated meetings in the White House and in the National Security Council. This is in the Eisenhower administration. And the members of the Eisenhower National Security Team were having big debates amongst themselves over and over again. And the basic topic was, our strategy for defending Europe is going to stop making sense pretty soon. And the reason our strategy for defending Europe is going to stop making sense pretty soon is right now we can carry it out if we have to, and we could win this thing. We could destroy their nuclear forces, blunt their conventional offensive. But they were basically saying, in a couple years, in the near future, the Russians will have a sufficiently big, the Soviets will have a sufficiently big nuclear arsenal and sufficiently capable that we'll no longer be able to carry that out. That if we were to execute our war plan, they will retaliate and destroy us. And so the Eisenhower administration was racked with the question of what next? Our whole concept for defending the most important overseas interests for the United States was going to become internally inconsistent. Our strategy, you invade Western Europe, we initiate strategic nuclear war, we both die. How does that make sense? Right? And so this is what they were, and what's interesting is you can see over this period the senior advisors of the Eisenhower administration kind of falling off. So first it's the national security advisor who just says to the president, I don't think our strategy makes sense anymore. We've got to change. And he gets argued down. The president decides not to change. And then the secretary of state, I think it was John Foster Dulles, he pulls out. And pretty soon, by 1959, 1960, the last man standing is the president. He's the only one who still thinks they should keep it. And his argument is not that this is a good way to do business. It's we just don't have any other better options right now because a conventional defense of Europe is not possible. So it's a lousy plan, but it's the only plan. 1961 happens, the Kennedy administration comes in. The first year they don't change the plan. And here's the big change. Starting in 1962, you go from an era in which you only have one option. If the Russians start World War III, there was one plan and one plan only. There wasn't option 13-7, option 13-B, option 21. There was one. And in fact, in these debates, people kept saying to the president, Mr. President, don't you want more options? Don't you want to have a choice? If I call you and say, in the Berlin crisis, which is going on, the Russians have crossed into West Germany, don't you want to have options? And he said, no, I don't want to have options. I don't need options. We have one war plan. It's been coordinated with the Allies. That's what we're going to do, that plan. 1962, that's the first year the Kennedy administration stayed the same. 62, they've gone from a single war plan, massive use, to options. And that's where it is for the rest of the Cold War. And they call the options different things, the countervailing strategy, the no-city strategy, they had all these different options. But to me, the way I read that is a period in which the leaders knew what they wanted to do. They didn't want the war, but they knew what they would do if war came, to a period where they didn't know what they were going to do, where they understood that all their options stunk. And they had conversations where they talked about all their options, and they knew all their options stunk. But the way they dealt with the ambiguity of knowing all their options were terrible is just to have lots of options and say, we'll figure out what we'll do if, God forbid, that circumstance comes. So the point being is, this is not when the big change happens. This is not when the big change happens. This is when the big change happens. From a single plan, we're going to go nuclear at the outset of the war, to we don't know what we're going to do. Which is the answer to your question from the beginning, Joel, which is in this period, we were not going to let there be a conventional war in Europe. If they start a conventional war in Europe, we go nuclear. Here is where we have options. Yes, sir, and then you, sir.
Patrick. Were we limiting our, when we, if in the situation where we were trying to captivate their nuclear strike capability,
yeah.
are we limiting ourselves to using only the nuclear bombs we have to blow up their nuclear bombs, or would they conceive like carpet bombing or dropping a big data cutter on those military?
You're talking about the late 1950s?
Yeah.
The operations against the Russians in this case were going to all be nuclear. We didn't have the accuracy, we didn't have the reliability of the other things. There were no conventional counterforce options.
Isn't massive firebombing or massive carbon bombing nuclear equivalent in that sense? Or in destructive capability?
In aggregate, destructive capability may be, but keep in mind that in order to carry out these big fire raids, whether it's against Hamburg or Dresden or Tokyo, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of bombers. And, you know, pre-positioned within a couple hundred miles of the target and trained to fly in big. Here you're talking about, you know, each bomber being able to destroy three or four separate targets, not 300 bombers for a single target. So there was just no possibility of doing this with conventional forces. Joel?
I think
it's
the second person.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So in 62, is this when the United States basically put a substantial garrison in Europe, or did this happen earlier?
The conventional forces kind of grow gradually over this period, largely because of this process, largely because they realize we need more capabilities. We can't rely on nuclear weapons in the coming age of stalemate. The big jump on that being 1955, I think it was when West Germany gets led into NATO, and then Germany is allowed to militarize and rearm. But yeah, so this is the period of growth of U.S. growth of NATO's conventional forces. But by 5960, because they saw this coming, the conventional forces were not inconsequential. Yes, sir, then you.
So, going back to the original sort of question about deterrence, at least when looking at this time period, it seems as though as you approach successful deterrence, you actually make yourself more vulnerable to nuclear attack, that you're having the opposite effect in inviting more offense until you reach deterrence, and then it's just like, then you're golden. How would you compare that to what you would consider the evolution of deterrence of, you know, say, some country in the Middle East or something like that today?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's what the conclusion I draw from this. For this case, and then someone asked the question of generalizability, and we'll get back to that.
Right.
But it's that, so there are two different levels at which things are happening. One is building an arsenal which has the effect of convincing people to take a wide course around you, to not mess with you. I think that type of deterrence works at a very low level, is that you have a very small arsenal, vulnerable, and people don't want to get into a conflict with you. They treat you with a lot more care, etc. There's a second level of deterrence, which if a conflict happens between us, if we have a crisis, if we have a conventional conflict, what does it take to make them think, I'm not going to go after your nuclear force as a way of resolving that? That this case at least suggests that the low arsenal on this causes you a lot more problems at that level. It turned a terrible thing happening to Russia to Russia's never going to recover. And arguably, although we don't know this, it could have put the United States in a position where we had to go quickly and didn't have time to think and didn't have time to reflect if war started. So I think a small deterrent can be very dangerous. That's one of the...
Okay. So
is that a segue? I'm sorry.
Just wrapping this up.
Yep.
So as it applies to situations today, a country might have a successful, say, North Korea or whatever.
Or Israel.
It might be able to successfully deter those nations in close proximity to it while making itself, just going with this, pretending we can generalize, while making itself more vulnerable to more powerful, perhaps less close nations.
So let me say this, so to put a fine point on this, in the Korea case, and I can say this, to be careful. So in the North Korea case, I can say this. It is consistent with this finding, and it is also my belief about the North Korea situation, that North Korea's small nuclear arsenal makes us very cautious of them. Cautious about confronting them, cautious about even retaliating if they do something highly provocative. That said, if there is a conventional war on the Korean Peninsula, I think there are going to be very, very strong forces pushing the United States to use conventional forces to attack as hard and as fast as we can North Korea's nuclear forces. In fact, I talked to somebody very recently who was the commander. He was in charge. He was the operationally a very senior position of U.S. Air Forces and Combined Forces Command, meaning the people who could be conducting the U.S. air operations, not today, but roughly 6 months ago, if war had come. And he basically, I gave a talk like the second talk, which now might not happen, the second talk, and he said to me privately, he said, I can tell you, what we were doing the first 5 days of the war was running every conventional operation we could to destroy their nuclear arsenal, for exactly that reason. So do small deterrents have a good effect? Yeah, they make us cautious. Do they have this other effect, which is creating powerful incentives for going, trying to destroy them? I think they do both. I think that's what this book is.
Dan's question could be a segue into some sort of a summary of what you were intending to do, but if we can bring you down again.
Yes, what should I do? Because we're obviously, because of all the Q&A, I assume has been useful for you guys, because you haven't been doing it, but that's meant that this has gone much slower. So what should we do? Should I summarize this and just go right into the second presentation real quickly? Well, what do you want to do? Do you want to?
Well, I'm thinking, I'm going to look to you guys because this is for you. Do you have more extended questions that you want to ask on this, or do you want to get a preview of what the summary of these phases is?
Most important, what are our time constraints?
Time constraints for Darrow, I think, really hit at 5:30, right? Isn't that what you had? You had a dinner or something? I'm not sure.
I'm having coffee or a beer. Or coffee and three beers or something like that. Professor Greenhill in the back.
Welcome, Kelly.
Oh, that
how
close to me?
Yeah. No. So okay, let's say we're gonna cut this off at 5:45. How's that? 5:40.
Does that work for this class?
Yeah.
We have the room until 6:30.
Okay. So let me summarize this talk, and then we'll stop with this.
I know there are other questions. You know, there's a lot. The bottom line is to say, in this historical period, and that's this historical period. Number one, the U.S. was willing to rely upon. To rely upon nuclear weapons as the way we were going to fight that war. Not one of four options, not one of four plans, the one and only plan, through the period of existential deterrence, through the period of minimal deterrence, until they had an assured retaliatory capability against the U.S. And that's when we said, well, that's not a very nice way to fight. We're going to have to think of a new way, et cetera. We never disavowed the nuclear option. And I think we always would have used nuclear weapons if push came to shove. But we went from it being the way we were going to fight to that's one option. We're going to look for graduated options. We're going to try to delay nuclear escalation, et cetera. A pretty profound change. Second of all, most important, is that it's not just the two things changed near each other. There were all these explicit discussions in the U.S. government, in both the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy administration, about why we had to make the change. And the change was made because of this reason. They kept saying, pretty soon we won't be able to destroy them all. Pretty soon they'll be able to retaliate against us, et cetera. What's also chillingly clear is that the U.S. allies hated our strategy throughout this period. They also hated the alternatives. They hated the notion we were going to fight conventionally. They hated the notion that they were going to have to make bigger defense commitments. But they were terrified of the idea that our answer to invasion of West Germany was we were going to go to strategic nuclear war. And the Brits complained to us. And there were these chilling telegrams between Macmillan and his embassy in Washington. He's like, do the Americans understand? This is in the middle of the Berlin crisis, in 59, I think. Do the Americans understand that if we execute our joint NATO war plan, all of the United Kingdom is going to be utterly, completely destroyed. The Americans are going to be safe, but we're all going to be killed. Do the Americans understand that, and would they consider revising the war plan? And the answer back to the embassy is, the Americans understand this, and they will not revise the war plan. Period. And we're like, we don't think it's going to come to that. We think we'll be deterred, but this is the only plan we have.
That's a staggering thought, folks. All right. Let's take a few more questions to try to wrap this up,
yep.
Because I want to use the energy of everything that's happened here to... I'd rather have more summary conversation,
yep.
And more questions and answers.
Okay.
It's more fulfilling to try to open up the new aspect. I don't know, Darrow,
you don't have to do
this semester. Is it possible to bring you down later in the semester?
It is possible. Yeah. It is possible.
Dinner or whatever.
Yeah, let's table that. How long does this class go? Until when? I don't mean today, I mean until...
Oh, it goes through February.
Okay, it's possible we can do the second one. We'll talk about it. So, yeah, so what do you want to do? Just open this up to general conversation.
I think there's been so much provocation here.
Yeah.
So much open, and you can, you know, some of your examples. I mean, obviously, you read the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
In terms of your work. So if people have questions relative to that, you can do that.
Let me open up the general conversation with one thing. It's the question about generalizability, which is, in a way, the most important kind of issue here, which is, I'd say this. Do I think most crises and most political confrontations are like the Cold War? Thankfully, no. Even if things got really nasty in terms of political competition between the United States and China, it's got, in many ways, it's not as bad as the Cold War. Geography, the beauty of water boundaries, so many things are different. We're a different country. I think we care much differently about non-combatant casualties than we did back then. We're different people. These folks, Eisenhower administration, Kennedy administration folks, they all fought World War II. They burned down cities before. Everything is different. So in terms of generalizability, that's kind of one thing to keep in mind. That said, here's the reason why I think this is really a key finding. It's because whether you're an Israeli planner or Chinese planner or American planner or Iranian planner, force planner, you build presumably a nuclear arsenal with the following, with perhaps lots of goals. Somebody said they might have other political goals they're trying to accomplish with their arsenal. But in terms of the mission of ensuring that adversaries will not be tempted to disarm you with a strike, you presumably build the arsenal asking, I want to have a force sufficient to deter not crazy, unlike leaders, but plausible adversary leaders in plausible, dangerous circumstances. And what we've at least found is, in this one case, some rather unaggressive leaders, democratic, small d democratic, democratically elected, normal guys like Dwight Eisenhower and John Kennedy, who were not megalomaniacs who wanted to own Western Europe. In fact, one of them was even a Democrat. I'm just joking about that. But the Soviets had to build a lot of nuclear capability before they got non-aggressive, status quo, democratically elected leaders to say, all right, nuclear weapons is not the answer to this problem. So if you were actually building an arsenal to say, I don't know, you're the Israelis, I don't know which Iranian leader we're going to face next or what bad situations they're going to face. Or you're the Iranians saying, I don't trust the Israelis, I don't know what crazy leader they're going to have. Or you're the Chinese, this is gonna push you, based on logic, to say, I've got to have an arsenal that's at least as big as the one, or at least as capable as the one that it took to deter the Eisenhower administration, the Kennedy administration. One last caveat, that doesn't mean a huge arsenal. You can actually get a survivable arsenal with a few hundred weapons. The British today, a few hundred weapons, but deployed in a fashion that's highly survivable. So this is not a case for huge arsenals, but it's a case for saying that at least in this case, existential deterrence didn't do it. Minimal deterrence didn't do it. And if you're building a force for country X in the future, and if you're worried about facing people just as bloodthirsty as Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, or perhaps worse, you want to make sure your arsenal is structured in a fashion that is not vulnerable to preemption, and it's large enough to inflict quite a bit of damage on the adversary. So I'm going to leave it there. Any kind of conversation you want, go for it.
Can I introduce the question of numbers here? One of the things you said earlier on in terms of, you know, verifiability, errorless data, and, you know, Kelly, this is a perfect segue to publish a book on numbers, right? You know, the confusion often happens here between, you know, warheads and suddenly merging, multiple independent reentry. I mean, the difference between your stalk and your, you know, so there's a threshold here when this radically changes when that technology occurs. And part of the questions you were asking earlier, Joel, in terms of how things are decommissioned, or there's a huge question here of verification, there's a huge question of how people count, and it's just a thoughtful thing to be concerned about and to ask, you know, when you put your statistics up, what are you talking about? Are you talking about independent vehicles, warheads at what point to be merged, and, you know, that's what MX is all about in terms of the threshold. So.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, open up. You've been great so far, a lot of good questions, but I'm going to request that Will and Joel and Dan will hold your questions for a minute.
And sure, I'm going to have you guide the discussion now. You call and
people. Well, I'm just going to, I just want to diversify the base.
Good.
So, yes, our hooker over here.
Excuse me?
Yes, I know, I love that. On the rugby team.
I'm not on the rugby. That's me.
That's you, Will? You're the hooker? Okay. You're the hooker.
If anyone's taking notes, it makes real clear that was Sherm's comment, not Barry.
Oh, the hammer torse. Exactly right, the hammer torse. Okay, so hammer torse, Cullen.
Yes, sir. Cullen?
Cullen, pardon me. A few weeks ago on Freedom Zakaria, he referenced this report from, I think it's Strategic Policy and Planning of the Air Force Headquarters, and it was said by Colonel Salzman that a stable deterrence of 311 nuclear weapons should be considered.
Right.
Has that been, like, thrown around recently?
So this gets... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No.
So this now gets right to the heart of the Austin question from before, which is if you were designing a U.S. nuclear arsenal for one purpose and one purpose only, meaning to be invulnerable to attack, invulnerable to complete destruction in an attack, and have the capability of inflicting highly unpleasant damage on whoever did attack you after the fact. I don't know if the magic number is 311 or 216 or 706, but it's probably something in that 300 is plausible. The reason we have a bigger arsenal than that today, this gets right to Austin's question, is that is one mission for the U.S. nuclear arsenal today, even under current President Obama guidance. That is not the only mission for U.S. nuclear weapons. The other mission for U.S. nuclear weapons is, in the case in which adversaries attack the United States or U.S. allies, if deterrence fails, we the United States, by presidential guidance, would like to have capabilities to destroy as many as possible of adversary nuclear weapons after their attack. So, in other words, if North Korea uses nuclear weapons against Tokyo, let's say, the guidance to the United States Strategic Command is you need to be able, in that circumstance, provide the president with options, which the president can take or not, to destroy as much of the North Korean nuclear arsenal at that point as possible. That's what's driving U.S. forces above the 311. It's because it's only the survivable retaliatory force is one component of the mission for deterrence, but it's only one. You're calling people.
So how could things have been done differently? Like, with placing aside the advantage of hindsight, these all seem like relatively, like, not entirely, but like understandable conclusions for U.S. policymakers to come to, given the lack of knowledge about Soviet capabilities. So what other choices could they have made at the time?
So I'm one of the few people who think that we should be celebrating the Cold War as an amazing success. I think there was an excess toward the end in the force requirements. We probably didn't need 10,000 deliverable weapons. I don't know if we could have got by with 4,000 or whatever. But I view the Cold War differently. I say it is remarkable that these two countries with as many reasons to fight each other as they had, and I don't think good reasons, I don't think they're smart reasons, but just reasons that have played out in history over and over again that draw peoples and countries into war. And we avoided it. And how could we have done it differently? So, I mean, Sherman was mentioning the Peacekeeper missile, which a lot of smart people opposed for good smart reasons. I think it's a good thing that we didn't deploy that. The things but at the end of the day, I guess, I'm not super critical of this aspect of our policy. And it's kind of hard to we have to go into details as to why, but the problem of deterring, of maintaining deterrence and extended deterrence was not trivial. And I think we now know that in the post-Stalin years, in the 60s and 70s, especially the 70s and 80s, the Soviet Union was less aggressive than many hawks assumed them to be. I think we now know. But I don't know if that was a totally prudent assumption during the Cold War in the absence of a lot of material. So I kind of think we played it roughly right. We were excessive, but I'm not. For whatever reason, I've never been tempted to really be too critical about that. And I'm willing to be critical of lots of things. Is that crazy or a little?
One of the things we're going to be able to do is with Richard Garvin and others from the Jason group, you know, come in and take a look at the progression that you looked at in terms of how people targeted and how they went. I mean, the madness was not the mutual assured destruction necessarily.
Yes.
The madness was the target.
Yes, exactly. That's it. So our requirements were absurd. So, like, the requirements were, like, we have to be able to destroy 25% of industrial production of the Russians and 35% of their population. And I think that's rather excessive. And there was target, and Lynn Eden wrote a phenomenal book about some of the excesses in our targeting. Like, we only looked at the overpressure effects and not the thermal effects. And so we vastly, and not the fallout effects necessarily. So we so that led to excesses. Totally agreed.
Okay. John.
My question is, I was reading a while back that, like, you know, the Russians were built, like, designed and developed a new, like, nuclear submarine, new weapons. And it seems like, the United States, we haven't done as much lately, like, since then, the Cold War, to try to develop, like, a modern, more, like, effective weapon. Is that necessary? Do we need to try to catch up, or
So the strategic competition, So the strategic competition has evolved in a different way. I think we made a mistake, Kira and I did, we've learned things since writing that first article. I think that you referenced or somebody else referenced the nuclear primacy article.
It was Logan.
Logan. The nuclear primacy article, the foreign affairs article, made two arguments, that first foreign affairs argument. Argument number one was, we've been living in the situation of MAD for 25, 35, 40 years now, but we're actually entering an era where the United States, where the nuclear balance has shifted in profound ways that deserve close attention and create some alarm in terms of the U.S. ability to win nuclear wars in a way we couldn't since 1962. And the point of the article was to say the balance has changed. You guys ought to know that. You guys ought to have a debate whether that makes sense. Argument that I think that's right. And we've done a lot of argument with Air Force folks and with Navy folks and with engineers, and basically no one has disputed that, that fact, effectively. The second part is where I think we missed it by 50%, where we said we think this was an intentional policy of the United States. What I would say that we've now learned is the intentional objective of the United States military policy is to work hard to try to neutralize adversaries' nuclear arsenals. Only a small element of that is via our nuclear arsenal. So the competition is not just our nuclear arsenal against their nuclear arsenal. It's a variety of things that we're doing simultaneously to try to give us the ability to neutralize adversary nuclear arsenals in case it comes to it. What are these things? First of all, very capable nuclear weapons. Second of all the conventional strike things that we have in the current conventional force. Third thing, you ever heard of conventional precision global strike? So these are the efforts to develop new ways of basically using things like ICBMs, long-range missiles, to be able to basically destroy anything you want within 30 minutes wherever it is in the world, conventionally, with conventional weapons. Number four, big investments in anti-submarine warfare, which is a conventional weapon for us, but it's a way of holding at risk other people's nuclear weapons, read China's. Remember there was this weird dispute, naval dispute between the U.S. and China 8 months ago, where we were just doing some mapping in the Pacific Ocean, and these darn Chinese were like throwing logs into the water to damage our mapping ship. And what is making maps, right? What were we doing? We were mapping the underground waters all around their submarine bases. So if you know where all the bumps and ridges are before the conflict happens, then you know which extra bump suddenly appears there when you're looking for subs. And they didn't want us doing it, you know. So it's the efforts that we're doing to try to neutralize other people's nuclear weapons include advancements in what's called, all kinds of advancements with drones to try to find movable targets. So this new Global Hawk Block 40 is about finding mobile missiles. Anti-submarine warfare and anti-submarine robotics to find submarines. Precision global strike, conventional, all the normal conventional capabilities. Cyber, and missile defense. We're using all of these things together for the purpose. I don't think that we're trying to take over the world. What I think we're trying to do is the military is doing, as I said before, all smart militaries do in peacetime, is try to figure out ways of defeating adversary military capabilities if war comes. And that's what we're doing. So it's not a nuclear effort. That's one small part of the puzzle.
BJ.
Hi, BJ. Professor, I was actually about to ask a question kind of related to that. And just to follow that up, do you see possibly China or Russia or other major nuclear powers following on those same lines that the U.S. may be doing right now with anti-submarine defense, missile defense, to kind of shift the arms race or what was the arms race from offensive to defensive, basically, in the more conventional?
So they are definitely responding to this kind of argument, not because they learned it from me. They understood this quite well. For many, many years, the Chinese lived with large, vulnerable, fixed-site ICBMs, and the reason was because they principally feared the Russians, and their medium-range nuclear systems were mobile. Now, as we get more on the radar screen, the Chinese, at considerable expense, have made sure that their new generation of ICBMs are mobile, so that they're trying to get into a world of assured retaliation, in other words. And at considerable expense, they're starting to lay a second generation of nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarine. Now, when you talk to Chinese planners, they basically say, we know our nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines are going to be totally vulnerable to the U.S. Navy for the next 10, 20 years. But they're like, we'll never get to a world of an invulnerable second strike force until we go through these multiple generations of vulnerable systems and go through all the learning curve, and then we'll get it. So they're in the long-run game, but they understand this. And one of the cautions that this gets is when you see the Chinese develop 50 or 75 more mobile ICBMs and lay 5 or 6 or 7 new ballistic missile submarines, Hawks in Washington will say, look at this, they're coming, Red Dawn 2. The Chinese are after us, they're aggressive. There's a second alternative interpretation of this, which is they'd be derelict not to create a second strike retaliatory force. Now, they might also be coming and trying to plan, I have no idea, but don't interpret their actions to try to get a secure retaliatory force as evidence that they're coming after.
This is the spiral that is so critical for us. One spiral is DNA, and this is the other one. This is the helix we're going to have to really contend with throughout, and it has to do with capabilities, intentions, interpretations. This is where you get, you know, the religion that you talked about earlier. Okay, Roy.
Roy. This may be kind of a naive question.
I think you're a first-year student.
Yeah, but I mean,
first-year students are allowed naive questions.
Cool.
Well, we've been kind of skating around the issue the whole lecture. If you can do all this stuff with conventional weapons, why nuclear weapons? What's the purpose? I mean, like, I guess you're going to show.
Awesome.
Great. No, exactly my question. The presentation I didn't give you and cannot give you. But
we'll get it another way.
I'll give you one slide. That's the same one. Is that the bottom one?
So we're going to go, guys, by consensus to a quarter of 20 minutes. Is that okay?
If anybody has to leave, I'm not going to be offended.
Are we going to stand in the way of the acquisition of knowledge?
Yes.
Whoa, I will buy you a drink.
So all this good stuff. See, look at all those pretty slides that you could have had. You know, North Korean targets and fallout patterns over Japan and Korea and CDPs and fatalities on the ground. No, we can't do it, Mr. Kelly. No, we don't have time. It's because you guys were asking lots of good questions, which was awesome. The big upshot.
No, we may travel to Dartmouth.
You're welcome to. The big upshot. So this is the one that. So the big central argument we make in the second presentation is the United States current is basically, and there's all this debate about how low we should go. Should we go to 300, 500, 700? We're like, that's fine, but that's not the right debate. The right debate we should have is as we go down in numbers, what forces should we keep in the arsenal? Does a nuke equal a nuke, or are there big distinctions? When people get one step into this beyond a nuke doesn't equal a nuke, they usually think in terms of retaliatory systems and survivability. Bombers good, survivable. You know, I'm sorry, not bombers. Subs good because they're survivable. Bombers bad, whatever. We're saying there are actually key distinctions in terms of the deterrent utility of the weapons and the usability of the weapons, and that's good and it's bad. But the point is this: is what we basically argued is there's a current capability in the U.S. arsenal, which is in the conventional forces. So if you see a big fixed silo somewhere and you want to destroy it, the United States has a great deal of capability to destroy it, and that capability is growing. But so, for example, for the purpose of this, we just asked, China has roughly 20 fixed ICBMs, 21, 22, fixed ICBMs. And the United States probably, when I was trying to kind of go into the details, could fly B-2s over those ICBMs and dropped conventional precision bombs on them. And if you assume, and it's an assumption, so these are existing weapons. It's a JDAM, which is just a bomb off a B-2 with a GPS guidance on it. And this is a DJ-109 Tomahawk, a naval launch cruise missile. If you assume these are existing weapons, that the United States can get the GPS signal all the way down, meaning that there's not effective local jamming, I'm not sure I'd assume that. But if you do assume, when you do all the math, which we could talk about, you have about a 50-50 chance of going 20 for 20. Now you might wonder why that's so small. The odds of destroying any given target is like 97, 98, 99, if you use six weapons. 97, 98, 99%. But then if you just take 97, 98, 99, whatever the number is, to the 20th power, it goes down. You get about 50-50, if you assume. If GPS is not available, either because it's being effectively locally jammed, or the satellites have been attacked, or there's been a variety of other things we can't talk about that could interfere with them, there's no way you're going to get them with conventional. But that's a real capability, conventional. Good news? Fallout casualties, basically, at least not from our weapons, okay? Then there's the other one. When you really, 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 really want to destroy the target, this is the sledgehammer option in the current force, which is you've got these submarines in the Pacific. They have a bunch of what are called W-88 warheads. They're very accurate. They are mind-bogglingly explosive in terms of the nuclear power. You have almost certainty of getting all 20 targets. There's a downside. The downside is you're going to kill millions and millions of people on the ground. And not even from the direct physical effect of the weapons, it's from the fallout. And the standard way you do targeting in a counterforce, which is what that is, counterforce role, is where you use ground burst detonations or near ground burst. And that pulls up a lot of material, material into the fireball, mixes the radioactive product, and wherever it falls, it kills lots of people. So good news, you have some capability here. You can probably maybe get them all if GPS works, which it probably isn't. You're not going to kill that many people on the ground. Here, good news is you've got a capability that will almost certainly get the targets. It's GPS independent.
Why?
Because it doesn't use GPS as a guidance system. It's inertial guidance with a stellar update outside the atmosphere. And so it doesn't require
satellite targeting?
Say what? So it's, I mean, it's just, it's basically, it's inertial navigation, so it's the same kind of guidance systems and gyroscopes they use to launch, I guess.
This kind of lecture is going to be what you're going to get in February when you're witting the old kinds of these terms, etc. This is
but just take my word for it, it's not GPS dependent. The cool thing, terrible thing, horrifying thing, fascinating thing, is there's this middle capability in the current force. And the middle capability is with existing low-yield weapons in the current force that have, look at the difference in yields, 450 kilotons. That's roughly, what, 20 Hiroshimas?
20 Hiroshima bombs, yeah. More.
20 Hiroshima bombs. This is a fourth of a Hiroshima, give or take. This is, somebody do the math for me, a 60th of a Hiroshima, roughly. Much smaller yields in the current force. I'm not talking about new weapons, which, depending on some assumptions we could talk about, can basically be as effective as these. And yet, check out the fallout fatalities. The fallout fatalities are in the order of those. So the argument we were making in the second piece was, we currently have three distinct capabilities. We have conventional, we have hammer of God, and you have something here that gives you the ability to get pretty close to this in terms of counterforce capability, but as fatalities close to that. Still involves breaking the nuclear taboo. So the whole argument was, as we go down, 1550, maybe 1,000, maybe 800, there are reasons that we argue that says, well, first of all, just know there are these distinct capabilities. Nuclear does not necessarily mean millions. Second of all is, we were making an argument, here people can disagree with us, that we ought to keep all those three capabilities. We ought to keep some of these in the force, you ought to keep some of these. And that might not be a done deal, which is some changes that we're doing in the arsenal might take away that middle capability if we screw it up.
Remember what we did with Mr. Bunn last time, male, female. All right, so Alexa.
Okay, before you said you're not a zero guy, you don't believe that we should be reducing our arsenals through whatever international agreement to zero.
To zero. I'm okay with reducing. I don't want to go to zero.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, I mean, this is like a large thematic question, but it's just kind of been nagging at me all of class. The four methods that you gave us before, like you said, make a whole lot of sense logically. And when you're looking at leaders, certainly you look at America, Russia, UK, that kind of stuff, it makes perfect sense. But I've just been wondering, when you get these unstable leaders with a history of unstable governments, like say India and Pakistan or say North Korea, how do you interpret that they deal, or I guess my question is, do you think that they should go down to zero? And how do you feel like they should be interpreted? Because we can kind of predict how countries like us are going to act. But I'm not sure we can predict countries like North Korea who say, may not care if a lot of their, if they're retaliating back against, if they lose their own civilians.
Yeah, we need like three class on this. It's exactly the right question. Kind of just a couple scattered shots on this.
It's like a very large question.
No, you shouldn't apologize. It's the question in many respects. A lot of thoughts, which is, there are some people who are willing to say, I think nuclear weapons make the world a better place. I'm willing to say that. Who will deny that bad things could happen. Oh, no, don't worry. Leaders will always be rational. Oh, don't worry. Nuclear armed states will never have revolutions. There'll never be these problems. I won't make that argument. I think there's dangers associated with them. I would say the following. Number one is, I think that the people who wish, putting aside feasibility, just in terms of goal, who wish for zero, it feels a little, I don't want to be rude, it feels a little bit in my mind like the people who don't want a vaccine. Like people are like, I don't know, a damn person who has polio. And so if there's any risk associated with giving my children the polio vaccine, I'm not really interested. And I'd love to, I would want to tell those people is compare the world before the polio vaccines and afterwards. That perhaps one of the reasons why you don't know people with polio is because of the vaccines. And the world before those vaccines is really terrible. Now, if you could get everyone else to take the vaccine and you not, maybe you're okay. To me, that's the same story with nuclear weapons, which is, was the world a nice place before 1945? And it's not such a great place now if you live in sub-Saharan Africa and you're living in the Congo. So nuclear weapons are going to end all those situations, but the existence of nuclear weapons in the world, in my view, has had a powerful contributing effect to the virtual elimination of some kinds of wars. And those some kinds of wars include the most catastrophic, violent, terrible, murderous that the world's ever seen. So that's kind of the short version of why I think. I just ask people, do you really want to make the world back safe for World War I and World War II? And my answer is no. I think there are risks associated with maintaining nuclear weapons, but I'm willing, my judgment, not knowledge, it's judgment. On the issue of, well, what do we feel about the problem of less capable, less stable governments having those weapons, I guess I don't think there's an answer to that question other than try to slow their acquisition for that. But here's the problem with the, let's work down to zero to try to solve that problem. I think those are orthogonal issues. Because I don't believe that the reason Pakistan wants nuclear weapons is principally because we or India has nuclear weapons. I don't believe that the reason North Korea has nuclear weapons is because we have nuclear weapons. I think there might be 11 reasons they have them, but one of them at the core is Pakistan fears India's conventional weapons. North Korea fears our conventional weapons. And so I would wish to God that I could snap my fingers and prevent Pakistan or India or anybody else from having nuclear weapons. But I believe that no matter how low we go, they will maintain theirs, not because they're bad and not because they're stupid, but because they're vulnerable. Pakistan's vulnerable, North Korea's vulnerable, Iran's vulnerable, Israel's vulnerable. They need nuclear weapons, and we might prefer they don't have them. So I just feel there's the problem you raise is the right one, but to me there's a disconnect between us saying, because of that problem, we're going to march as close down to zero as we can get. I just don't think that's even on the track to solving that problem, because I think the Pakistanis, the Israelis, the North Koreans, and the Iranians would be stupid not to go down this road. The Iranians might have an asterisk. That's a short answer, not satisfying, I'm sorry. It's the time.
We're gonna bundle our questions so you can hear them.
Sure.
Maybe create an interaction, because this is going to be the last sequence.
Great.
So we've got Ian and Katie and Joel, Emily and Logan.
And here's one teaser. If you're not yet convinced we want to keep low-yield weapons in the arsenal, if we have to retaliate against North Korea with high-yield weapons, this is a software that does follow-up. This is the expected direction of the follow-up. So if North Korea uses a nuclear weapon against the United States in the course of a war, and we say, or against Japan, and we say, we told you, and we do a limited nuclear counterstrike, so this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 attacks on North Korea with the high-yield weapons, this is who dies. 2 million people die, about 40% of them in South Korea, and a bunch of people in Japan get sick. That's why high-yield nuclear weapons are not so appealing, and this is if you redo the model using low-yield weapons against the same sites. There you go. That's the other reason. It matters entirely. And the thing is, with high-yield nuclear weapons, you're unable to get the effects on the ground without creating fallout with low-yield weapons. You can't. All right. I'll pick up
that. Which is, all right. We'll get to that question in terms of altitude far later. All right. So,
you're under the opinion that nuclear weapons have some kind of a positive effect for deterrence. If you could create an ideal situation, if you could just assign weapons to whoever you want, how many countries would you give them to? Would there just be one country with them, or would, you know, an elite group? Would everyone have just two? What's the distribution of power in nuclear power?
Don't answer. We're going to take, and then maybe some of them will resonate. Is there something that's immediate amongst the 4 or 5 of you that's a follow-up to this that you can integrate? Emily?
Mine's fairly similar. Mine was just sort of going on with your analogy to vaccinating. So you're saying that a lot of countries are gaining nuclear weapons just because they want to be able to play in the field and have that same level of protection to sort of have that deterrent for themselves. So what happens if in, say, 50 years, every country that has any kind of influence on the world has, and we end up with a level playing field that everyone has deterrent? Is there going to be, again, carrying on the virus, some sort of like super bug type of thing that would come from that that would have? I'm just wondering, where does it end? Because right now we can see, you know, a visible sort of
reach, like a horizon, like,
you know, the United States would reach that, but what happens, you know, like 100 years down the line? Is there going to be something that's bigger, something that's, like, where do we go from there? They can't possibly be.
Awesome question.
I guess mine is kind of related to that. We were talking about even the solidarity system, lessons learned from that, and the Cold War. We're always talking about spheres of influence, and I think that some people would argue that you could point at any point in the globe, and if that was attacked, either the USSR or the US would be responsible for it. We don't live in a world like that anymore. So don't you think that countries are going to see that they don't have this extended deterrence anymore and want to develop their own programs? And is it possible that competition akin to what happened in the Cold War would reoccur between other countries?
Logan?
Mine's kind of different.
One second, is there anyone else that follows up on this in terms of where we're going to go? All right, so the party.
Go ahead, Logan.
I just, like, it seems to me as if the purpose, the way a warfare works out is there's a conventional force inside A and a conventional force inside B. And you have two armies fight each other, and once one side's army goes down, it leads to the threat of attack upon the loser's civilians that makes someone finally has to submit to the victor's demands.
You mean the stronger country, the guy's winning the conventional wars, his threat against the weaker state, the loser's side. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you draw punishment, you draw, you know, casualties to try and make someone submit.
Sure.
And maybe make an example. And missiles were kind of a way to bypass the idea of having to go through the army. And now nuclear weapons are another way to bypass this defense of the conventional weapons. And I'm kind of wondering, like, you know, if we're in a situation where we feel as if we need to engage in war, why, like, are we so victim to this construct that we have of ourselves that we are this sort of moral army that we, like, is it really a good idea for us not to inflict as much pain as possible upon an enemy of the United States of America, even if those casualties need to be in millions against the Italians, if it means that we can, you know, cut short the Spanish War?
And the last question was, Ian, you'd ask yours, right?
Yeah.
Joel?
This
is the last question, correct, of the sequence?
Okay. Is nuclear engagement with Russia at all possible at this point? Does it make sense to plan on that end? Why does basically Russia deploying nuclear weapons to the United States or Europe?
Oh, is a nuclear conflict?
Nuclear conflict with Russia.
Yeah.
And why is Russia clinging so desperately to the status quo of the nuclear power balance of Europe?
Excellent. U.S. planning. Okay, these are such awesome questions. First one is just a punch on. What's the ideal arsenal? I don't know the answer to that. And also, I couldn't do it because, the ideal arsenal from my perspective of what I would say is this, let me turn around this way, is, and this will get to the answer to the next one about where does it all end, is if I were a reasonable moral person, didn't want to kill non-combatants, didn't want to fight wars, but I was a citizen of China, I was a citizen of North Korea, I were a citizen of Israel. I don't know about the UK and France. China, North Korea, Israel, Iran, maybe Pakistan, definitely. I would be definitely on the side of my country having nuclear weapons. Not for prestige reasons, not for status reasons, just because I'd say this is the backstop we need because we might be conquered by somebody much more powerful than us. And how many weapons would I want? I'd want a few hundred. And so, now me, with my value set, who despises the type of government in the North that murders tens of thousands of their own people, it's weird. I don't want to say the ideal arsenal includes them having weapons. I hate that government. They're murderous. But if I were in their shoes, I would want these weapons. So I guess that's the best I can do to answer the question. Where does it end? That's such the right question. The good news is this, and I think this is one of the places, I don't agree a ton with Jim Walsh, who's here on the talk. He's a super smart guy. Super-duper smart guy. But this is where I think he's exactly right, and there's good news here, is that the end game here is not of 100 countries having nuclear weapons, I think. Because keep in mind, I keep coming up to the same 5 or 6 countries who really need these things. And it's people who, A, face a really big potential conventional threat. Okay? So Israel has good relations with Egypt today, and Syria today, and Jordan today. But you build an arsenal for who your threat might be and what they might look like 20 years from now also, because you don't know how things are going to change. It's not that many countries out there who face a big, powerful, potential conventional threat they might not be able to handle, who also have a set of adversaries who they are likely to get into wars with. So I don't think Canada needs nuclear weapons. I don't think Mexico needs nuclear weapons at this point.
That might follow today's article on Venezuela. Careful.
I didn't see this. But I do think, so the good news is I don't think it ends. So people are like, you're right, the world's stunk before the nuclear revolution. And you're right, our dismantling is not going to make those countries want nuclear weapons. But where does it all end? It's the right question. But it's a false image is that if we don't do something radically different, we're going to have a world of 50 nuclear states. And look at Jim's evidence. He's like, the pace of nuclear ownership has gone down and it's flattened off. And yeah, North Korea added it, but North Korea might be gone as a state in 10 years. Who knows? Iran might add it, but I'm not sure that makes Egypt need them. And Egypt didn't need them when Israel got them. So I think the playing this out, the scenario doesn't lead to 500 nuclear states or even 50 nuclear states. It might end up at 8. I'd rather there not be 8, but I think it might end up at 8. Real quickly, I'm getting tired.
roots of nuclear, holding people at risk. I don't remember the core of the question. I tried to do this kind of thing. Let me come back to this. Two thoughts on U.S.-Russia. One is, there was a funny charade, which everyone, I talked to people at STRATCOM, I talked to people in the Defense Department, talked to people in the Senate. The SALT treaties and the process there is a ridiculous process, and it's a charade. And the reason is, it's not ridiculous to reduce. It's not ridiculous to do that politically. But the weird thing about what's going on is we are basing our force reductions on the military relationship with a country with whom we are very unlikely to fight a war. So whatever our nuclear requirements are, whether they're 1550 or 1250 or 331, it probably doesn't have too much to do with the Russian arsenal. It has something to do with it. Principally, the U.S. is building, it's what I think Cullen said, suggested, or somebody did. We're building our arsenal with reference to a set of possible adversaries out there, and the mission requirement, not of burning down five cities in a country, that does not take many weapons, the mission requirement of having the capability, if they use nuclear weapons against us or our allies, of trying to, what they call damage limitation, reduce their arsenal in such a way that the Japanese don't take 20 hits, or the South Koreans don't. That's what's driving our arsenal. And the charade is senators asking General Chilton, who commands these forces, if we go down to 1550, sir, will you still be able to ride out a nuclear strike by the Russians and still retaliate? He says, yes, sir, based on my calculations, if you can. It's like, that's not what's driving the force, and everybody knows it. But, so that's it. Why is Russia clinging to it? And this is the overarching thing which I want to take. No, it's not, but it's a key thing I want you to take from it. Is nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons are the weapons of the weak. Not the weakest. They don't have them. They can't get them yet. They haven't bought them. But they're the weapons of the weak. Why did we like nuclear weapons in the Cold War? Because they had 135 divisions and we had two. Because we thought we couldn't win our conventional wars. We couldn't defend our key interests with conventional weapons. So we said, we got an answer. Nuclear weapons. You start a conventional war, we're going nuclear. They allowed us to stalemate a much stronger force. The Cold War ended, and who's got the most powerful conventional force on the planet? How do we feel about nuclear weapons these days? We've rethought things. It would be better if there were zero. It would be better if there were almost none. And so we talk about, et cetera. And surprisingly, who still likes these weapons? The Pakistanis, facing the Indians, Indian conventional force. The Israelis, facing people near them and people in their own head. The North Koreans, facing everybody. You know? The Chinese, scared of us. Right? Those are the countries and the Russians who are like, our army is falling apart, and it took a not insignificant effort to overrun Georgia. They want nuclear weapons. And so, to some extent, I just want you to understand the level of incredible cynicism here that is sometimes revealed when, you know, Perry and Schultz say, we can go down, global zero is good, we've got the most powerful conventional force in the world. Terrific. They just explained to you why there's no way in hell they're going to convince the Pakistanis or Israelis or North Koreans for this. Not because they're bad, but because they don't have the most powerful conventional force in the world, and they're afraid of people. So I'd say I think I know why the Russians have relied so heavily and continue to on nuclear deterrence. And it's just they're stalemating weapons. That's why the North Koreans want them, that's why I think the Iranians want them, though they might have other goals too. So
tour de force.
Darryl.